From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, Abdulrahim Fukara, Al Jazeera's regional director for the Americas, and our moderator is Shana Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Thanks for joining us. Here are the issues. The coronavirus pandemic spiraled out of control. Some good news as several highly effective vaccines appear to be within reach. And more than 2 weeks after the U.S. presidential election, President Trump continues to claim widespread fraud without evidence. Plus, the U.S. is set to draw down troops from the Middle East. What will that mean for U.S. national security and for that region? Tom, Abrahim, it's good to talk to both of you again, and we have a lot to talk about for this week's news. Let's start with the pandemic. It's been 8 months. It's clearly not going away. The numbers in the U.S., over 250,000 people have now died. That is a quarter of a million people. And you're seeing record new number of cases in recent days. States are now considering a second round of lockdowns. Tom, how did we get here?
Well, to be very blunt about it, I think because a lot of people in America just decided that wearing a mask was not necessary. And many millions of people in many states just stopped social distancing. We keep seeing on the internet these pictures of parties with 50 or 100 or many other people drinking and having a great time, not wearing masks. And I think there has been far greater transmission than we've seen for 6 months. I think a lot of people believe President Trump when he said we're rounding a corner. All the data shows that at the moment, very sadly, we're not rounding a corner.
Yeah, the president is claiming, though, that he has done a lot and that there would be many more lives lost without his leadership. But a lot of people are asking, where is he right now? He seems to have sort of disappeared, even as the number of cases go up and up, and we've now hit this really awful milestone of 250,000 deaths. We haven't really been hearing, Abrahim, much from the president on the pandemic.
No, we have not. I always say that I've been in the United States now for 20 years. And obviously, this country has gone through many different crises and shenanigans and has always been able to land on the right side of finding a solution to move on. But I've never seen anything like this in terms of the shenanigans going on about the result of the election and what that means for the pandemic. I mean, it was expected over the spring that come the summer, the pandemic would alleviate. That didn't happen. Then people were saying, well, maybe in the fall, things may get better. And that didn't happen. But we haven't heard, as you said, much from President Trump, because it seems to me that he's so preoccupied with the election situation and the shenanigans over the result of it with Joe Biden. But Joe Biden, it has to be said, especially over the last couple of days, he seems, without, you know, angling this in any way which may be seen as cynical, he seems to have found a way to actually consolidate his position a little bit in terms of warning Americans that unless he starts getting the information he needs to get from the Trump team, the impact of the pandemic in the United States is going to get a lot worse.
I'm going to just stop you there because we're going to talk about the transition and the hiccups there for our next topic. But certainly you are hearing complaints from the Biden team that because they're not officially certified by the obscure federal agency that does that, they're not getting access to the coronavirus task force, the data there, the resources the U.S. has. And so that when they do come into office, presumably January 20th, they're not going to be able to have all of this time to have been working on trying to get the country in a better shape for the pandemic. But we're going to talk more about that in a little bit. Tom, I want to go back to you about this idea of pandemic fatigue. We do have these two vaccines that appear to be highly effective that could possibly end the pandemic from Pfizer and Moderna. And there's a third one from another big pharma company. But we're also being told by public health experts that it's going to be months until these vaccines are widely distributed. So what do you think that's going to do to the American psyche? Is that going to sort of tell people, hold on and you know, stay safe until we get there? Or is it going to do the opposite? It will discourage people from taking more precautions because they feel like this is almost over.
Well, I think there's going to be some of both of that. I think there is incredible pandemic fatigue, and this is good news. Even health experts who have been critical of President Trump handling of all of this are saying this is the closest we're going to get to a gold standard of vaccine and testing, but it's going to take a while. I mean, unless you're a first responder or a healthcare professional, you may not be able to get the vaccine for several months. I'm hoping that more Americans will decide to rally around the notion that help is on the way and we can hold on for a couple more months and then we'll have vaccines. On the other hand, there are so many people out there who spurn masks. All the experts say that masks will stop the transmission or at least limit it significantly, and there are millions of people who don't believe that. It's troubling. I wish we had somebody in a position of leadership to say to the country, listen, ladies and gentlemen, here is the deal. If you don't wear your mask, somebody's going to die. It may not be you, but it might be a family member. It might be your grandmother or your grandfather or your aunt or your uncle, but somebody will die. I don't believe it's registering to the degree that it should.
Or that it did in the spring when this all started, and people seem to really be paying a lot more attention. And as you said, the months have been dragging on. And even though hospitals are now feeling overwhelmed by the amount of cases, people just don't seem to be focused on this. There are other things going on, certainly the election we'll talk about. But yeah, you mentioned the critics are saying President Trump's sort of flip-flopping on masks and wearing the masks has not helped. But then you have in California now, the governor of California, a Democrat, he's in a lot of hot water because there are pictures coming out. He was at a dinner party, no masks, no social distancing, and he's been telling people in his state, you have to be careful, don't gather for Thanksgiving, you need to be wearing masks, and he's not practicing what he preaches. So there's certainly mixed messages coming from a lot of areas and from different parties in this country. But I want to get a sense of what's going on around the world, Ebrahim, and I want to bring you in on this. Give us sort of the global snapshot of what's going on in Europe right now. They're dealing with another surge. Iran is facing its worst COVID outbreak yet. What steps are other countries taking? And the big question, like we're seeing here, are other people in other countries listening to their leaders?
It seems that there's a second wave, a second surge of pandemic happening in pretty much everywhere, a lot of places in Europe, as you mentioned, in Africa, other parts. Africa seems to be the surprise of the season, if I may call it that, because the norm has been, at least in the Western media, to say, you know, as far as pandemics and diseases, Africa is always ranks at the top, except that this time Africa seems to be doing quite well, at least in comparison with other parts of the world, including the United States. And that's a result of how various African countries have worked very closely together throughout the pandemic. You know, the result now is, at least now, we don't know what's going to happen in the future, but at least now the Africans seem to have a better handle on the pandemic than the Americans or even the Europeans. The Europeans, in terms of the reactions of the governments in Europe, there was a lot of concern, obviously, during the first wave. We've seen horrendous numbers in countries like Italy, for example, is really battered by the pandemic. But this time around, governments seem to have rallied around the idea that they have to work together and extend financial help to Europeans. You have countries like Germany, a powerful, rich country. You have even less rich countries such as Greece, basically helping companies, helping ordinary citizens financially to deal with the impact of the second wave. And that seems to have created a lot of, if you may call it, satisfaction among the people in Europe vis-a-vis what their governments are trying to do.
That's a really good sort of point to jump on, the economic fallout and what countries are doing to help people who are struggling financially. Let's talk here, Tom. So Congress pumped trillions of dollars into the economy, but they seem to be stuck on the next relief bill. How far apart are the Democrats and Republicans? And any chance something gets done before the new year?
Well, I hope so, Shana, but it doesn't look like it at the moment. They're not talking. The Democrats and the Republicans in Congress are about $1 to $2 trillion apart. And you get the feeling that especially the Senate Republicans have dug in their heels, are not going to support that kind of a figure. You would think that the country's legislative leaders would get together and say, we have to do something of an interim nature right now, before the end of the year. And at the moment, they're not interested in doing that. And, you know, people are dying, people are out of work, people are literally going hungry. And it's, it just seems to be a very callous game here. But everything is more or less tied up with the election results. And the end result of that is that Congress is paralyzed at the moment. It seems astonishing, but they are paralyzed at the moment.
Republicans will say they want to pass a skinny bill that's more targeted, and the Democrats are countering that a lot of money has to be thrown at this problem, and there are a lot of political fights going on right now and back and forth. But as you say, meanwhile, people are really struggling, people are dying, and people are losing jobs. It's a very big problem, especially for local governments who need extra help to deal with this crisis as well. And this is not a problem that's going to go away. I'm certain we're going to continue talking about that. Let's go to a break. And when we pick up from the break, we'll talk about the election, the results, and the transition, which both of you have mentioned. It's a big story. Let's get on to it.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. Abdulrahim Fukara, Al Jazeera's regional director for the Americas, and our moderator, Shayna Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Welcome back. It has been more than 2 weeks since the U.S. election, and President Trump still refuses to admit defeat, even though major news organizations have declared Joe Biden the winner based on ballot counts in key swing states. The president and his allies continue to try and overturn the result of the election, but their legal challenges aren't going so well. In fact, they've lost nearly every legal challenge so far. Abraham, they seem to be having difficulty proving this widespread fraud.
They do. And as you said, they've tried different avenues in different states, which would be important to the overall result. But so far, those haven't panned out in any significant ways. They may be able to change the count by a few hundred here, even a few thousand there, but that's not going to impact the overall result, which is that Joe Biden has carried this election. But, you know, if you wanted to be a little bit charitable to Trump, it has to be given to Trump and to his camp that they're not giving up. I mean, they're coming under intense pressure from the Biden camp, from even some of the Republicans in Congress and elsewhere, but they seem to be determined to continue. We don't know exactly what the end game for President Trump is. So far, he hasn't caved into pressure. And I also have to say that that's obviously raising concerns for many Americans about what that may mean for the democratic system in the United States and more immediately for the national security of the United States.
We'll get to the national security implications in a moment, and that's a really good point. But to Abraham's other point, what does it mean for the democracy when you have, Tom, new polls showing that at least half of Republican voters believe this election was rigged. They believe President Trump here, even if there's so much evidence to counter that.
This is very bad for democracy, Shayna. And let me remind listeners, President Trump is the 10th president I've covered. I started covering the White House in the last months of the Lyndon Johnson administration. So I've got some institutional memory here and institutional history, and I can tell you that none of the presidential transitions since Lyndon Johnson have been as contentious and as challenged and as contested as this, except for Bush versus Gore, but that was a legal challenge over a handful of votes in Florida. I can remember that when Jimmy Carter lost to Ronald Reagan, Jimmy Carter not only called to concede that night, but he promised President Reagan this will be the greatest, most successful transition in history. And every president who has lost for re-election, and all there was a transition between all of those presidents, and they all were relatively okay. But you've never had a situation, in my experience, where millions and millions and millions of Americans, mainly Trump supporters, believe that the election was stolen. And there is no evidence of that, but these are people who will not be deterred in that belief. And that is fundamentally bad for democracy. It's really bad also that the transition work has not been allowed to go forward because President Trump has said no transition until we get this sorted out.
even if President Trump does concede defeat, I mean, he is still going to be a major figure in the Republican Party, especially if he does decide or if he insists that he's going to run in 2024. Is that, Ibrahim, why you think we're seeing many Republicans, although some have sort of admitted that Joe Biden won, but we're seeing congressional leadership like Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Senate, not saying that Biden won because they don't want to get in President Trump's sort of crosshairs?
Possibly, but you'll have to remember that among the very many unprecedented things about the 2020 election, I would defer to Tom, obviously, in terms of his knowledge of previous administrations and how they've conducted themselves in transitions and during their administrations. But I don't think Americans have ever seen anything like President Donald Trump, both in terms of him saying what he thinks without worrying too much about being politically correct, but also in terms of the base that he's cultivated. They seem to believe in him and they seem to believe what he says through thick and thin. I mean, it's probably another instance of unprecedented that you have a president of the United States who was defeated in the election, even after about 70 million Americans have voted for him. And probably not all of those 70 million are his base. So he will continue to wield a lot of influence. Whether that's the reason why many Republicans are reluctant to say to him bluntly, you've lost, you need to move on and concede so that Joe Biden can become the legitimate president of the United States. But regardless whether he runs in 2024 or he doesn't, I think the base is here, his legacy is here, whether he disappears after this election or he stays. It becomes a huge challenge for Joe Biden to try and build bridges with the current base of President Trump, not just in terms of economic policy, but, you know, even in terms of science. This whole issue that President Trump has instigated among his base, that, you know, they don't have to wear a mask and that the pandemic may not necessarily be real, that's going to be a major challenge for Joe Biden moving forward, and maybe even in the election in 2024, people will continue to contend with this unprecedented polarization which currently exists in the United States.
It's a very big problem, and it's a good point that it's not only an issue of just unifying the country in general, but also around this issue of defeating the pandemic, or at least bringing the numbers down and getting everyone on the same page on the science. The other issue, Tom, is that there are many Republicans who feel like the Democrats have vilified them. And so there's a lot of just distrust and conflict on every side here in this country. It's going to be a big challenge to Joe Biden going forward. What are some of the other domestic issues Biden may face once he comes into office January 20th, Tom?
His immigration policy. He wants to roll back Trump's view of immigration. He wants to stop construction on the wall along the southern border with Mexico. He wants to raise taxes on wealthy Americans. The other one I would say is climate change and environmental issues. He wants to roll back many of President Trump's initiatives in this area. And a lot of Republicans in Congress don't want him to do that. But he's not going to be able to do as many things as he had hoped he would be able to do.
Yeah, certainly, as you point out, it's going to be much more difficult for him because the Democrats lost seats in the House. So they have a majority there, but it's a smaller majority. And they thought they were going to sweep the Senate. And that certainly didn't happen. Plus, you have the Democrats. There's infighting there between progressives and centrists. So Biden is going to face challenges not only from the Republicans, but from his own party. And then on the foreign policy front, Abdulrahim, I want to bring you in. What kind of challenges does Joe Biden face there?
Let me first of all say one theoretical challenge, which is the fact that it has to do with U.S. democracy, the way it's constructed. The president of the United States occupies an extremely powerful position, despite all the checks and balances of the U.S. political system. He can introduce change, he can change policies, the policies adopted by his predecessor, and that's his prerogative, and so on and so forth. But one challenge that he will face, let's take the Iran deal. Obama basically concluded that deal together with U.S. allies, with the Iranians. Then came President Trump, and he basically trashed it. And the issue for Biden will become, with other countries looking at that and saying, well, you know, if I conclude a deal with the Biden administration now, what guarantee do I have that the next administration will uphold and preserve that deal? So that's one challenge. But there are other challenges in terms of the policy with Iran itself. Biden is likely to want to bring back some aspects of the Iranian nuclear deal with Tehran. Obviously, President Donald Trump has made it very difficult for him to do that, but there, he still has a margin of a maneuver. There's the issue of Israel and Palestine. President Donald Trump has basically taken U.S. policy in an unprecedented direction by moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Obviously, Biden, I do not see how he can try to reverse that. He may want to go back to the two-state solution for which many people in the U.S., including many Jewish Americans, are clamoring because they're worried about the future of Israel as a Jewish state. China, I don't see how Biden's policy could be very different from Trump's policy, except that Biden will probably be a little bit better spoken about China, but the crux of the policy and the challenges that come with that policy will probably remain the same.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack in your answer, and certainly on China, we are seeing a hardening of rhetoric coming from both parties. So as you say, it doesn't seem like a lot will change there. And then with the Palestinian-Israel issue, so much has changed on the ground with Gulf states now normalizing relations with Israel, something that even some of the Democrats are praising. And then lastly, on the Iran deal, you know, Biden has said the U.S. would come back to the deal if Iran came back into compliance, but Iran continues to breach the deal. And plenty of critics of the deal, including some Democrats, believe the deal didn't go far enough to address Iran's other malign activities in the region, like funding terrorist groups and developing ballistic missiles. So this is not easy. This is going to be very complicated for Joe Biden. I want to stay in the Middle East because the U.S. this week announced that they are going to be withdrawing additional troops from Iraq and Afghanistan. You had the acting Secretary of Defense, Christopher Miller, announcing the U.S. is going to pull more troops from those countries, leaving around 2,500 in each country, down from 4,500 in Afghanistan, 3,000 in Iraq. This is all supposed to take place in mid-January, so just days before Biden gets into office. Tom, this is something, though, that President Trump has promised since his 2016 campaign, that he's going to be pulling troops out of the Middle East, getting the U.S. out of forever wars. So is this much of a surprise?
No, it's not that much of a surprise, except for the fact that his Joint Chiefs of Staff, his military leaders, and his civilian Pentagon leaders all opposed this. And the Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, sent a classified message recently to the White House saying this is a bad idea. So what happened? He was fired by President Trump, and we now have an acting Secretary of Defense, Christopher Miller, who will be there no longer than 8 weeks, the maximum. So it's not surprising that Trump did this. It's a little surprising that the president essentially ignored his entire military and defense chain of command, which he, of course, has every right to do. But whatever else it means is it means there's going to be turmoil in our policy in the Middle East. Of course, it raises the question of whether the remaining 2,500 troops in Iraq and Afghanistan are enough to do the job.
And Abraham, I'll let you have the last word here. What are regional players saying about this withdrawal and U.S. allies?
There is concern. First of all, about the withdrawal from Afghanistan, there's concern from the Afghan government itself. There's concern from some of the U.S. allies. There's concern from NATO that the time is not really right for withdrawing from Afghanistan. Many of these countries are pointing out that the Taliban continues to launch, and even President Trump's critics here in the United States are continuing to point out that the Taliban continues its attacks in Afghanistan. The time may not be right. Ditto for Iraq. There's a lot of concern. The green zone in Baghdad, which is the most important part of Baghdad, where the U.S. embassy is housed, came under attack in recent days. So a lot of people are cautioning that the timing may not be right. But I just want to say this to conclude, especially about Iraq. There will continue to be discussion about whether the U.S. should be militarily in Iraq or not. Whether you agree with it or not, there is absolutely no way for me that the U.S. can completely withdraw from Iraq, because Iraq is so central to U.S. strategic interests at this point in history.
Yeah, this is going to be certainly another challenge that the Biden team is going to have to contend with once they get into office. That is all the time we have. Thanks to Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, and Abdurrahim Fakara, Al Jazeera's regional director for the Americas. Great analysis from both of you. I really appreciate it. This program is produced by the Voice of America. I'm Shana Stulen. Thanks for listening and stay safe.